The Iqar and Kokar Report, episode number 54.
Welcome to the Iqar and Kokar Report, the podcast dedicated to making sense of healthcare. From policy to economics, from evidence-based medicine to ethics, join us as Drs. Michelle Iqar and Anish Kokar diagnose and treat the latest epidemic of healthcare absurdities.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining us on this episode of the Iqar and Kokar Report. I'm Michelle Iqar in San Francisco. Joining me is Anish, as always, from Philadelphia. And we're delighted to have with us Dr. Kathleen Brown. This is going to be, a different kind of episode because it will not be so much an interview as a real conversation between three physicians, all three of us in private practice, sharing notes, you know, comparing our different path, our different views or similar views about the healthcare system and how can one forge a decent career in private practice in the US today, and how it's been, what are the challenges, the rewards, the difficulties, and so forth. And Kathleen Brown is a perfect person to have this conversation with. I know Kathleen primarily through social media, through physician groups. And I'm always very amazed by your wisdom and the clarity of your analysis, Kathleen. So thank you for joining us.
Well, I hope I'll live up to that.
I'm sure you will. So Kathleen, you're practicing currently dermatology in Coos Bay, Oregon. And where, you know, so you'll give us a little bit of a background on your career path, your journey so far, in broad brush strokes.
Well, I'm a little unusual because I finished internal medicine after I finished dermatology. I was a double major in biology and music and couldn't make up my mind, and then couldn't make up my mind on my specialty. So I did both and practiced both for a period of time and then limited to dermatology. We were on the East Coast, Virginia, Maryland, DC, and then in 1997, took a bold move and moved out to the West Coast and enjoyed the outdoors and joined a really nice group. I would say an old-fashioned group. I won a good internal medicine group. And so I joined Bay Clinic and I was there for 13 and a half years.
So that was a group of internists?
I think 9 internists, 5 pediatricians, an obstetrician, and a gynecologist and an allergist.
And again, tell me that time frame for that when you joined that group.
So that was 1997 to 2011.
Okay. And in those days, it would have been a sort of a typical single specialty group, billing Medicare and private health insurance with hospital privileges, I suppose, at the local community hospital.
Yes, admitting people for TPA,
right.
ICU, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, did it all.
Okay. And what happened in 2011?
Well, I guess you call it Obamacare, Unaffordable Care Act for Dr. Keith Smith. I was opposed to that. I'd been concerned about what was going on in healthcare, and I just already had my fill of bureaucracy. But my real problem was Medicare. The coding system, it was just increasingly enmeshed in bureaucracy and finding it just onerous to practice medicine. So my husband, who's very entrepreneurial, helped me offer an alternative to myself and to my patients.
Okay.
And we opened in 2011.
Before we get there, tell me a little bit, were you, how did your colleagues perceive it in those days, or did they go along, or what were the reactions among the other internists?
Oh, that will never work. That was the reaction.
Not so much about your plans, but about what you were confronting, what was disenchanting you.
I guess I heard a lot of grumbling, but I guess I felt a little alone and feeling so dissatisfied with it.
Okay.
Did they So you had, just to be clear, you were in Oregon as part of a larger dermatology practice before 2011 hit. Is that correct?
Internal medicine practice.
It was a multi-specialty, but mostly internal medicine and pediatrics.
I see. And you were doing most of the dermatology, is that right?
All of the dermatology.
You were doing everything, all the dermatology. All right. Mm-hmm. But so even at that point, you had kind of, you're part of this multi-specialty group, and all the referrals, you would essentially, you know, the group would refer you the dermatology work, and you would.
Right. I joined as an internist and said, could you also use a dermatologist, and became extremely busy. And after 2 years, I dropped internal medicine because I was overwhelmingly busy.
So now, as part of a larger practice, weren't they dealing with a lot of the stuff that, you know, a lot of the Obamacare type of the regulations and, you know, in terms of billing and payment and what were the, could you go through some of the
pressures? Okay. So here's the interesting part. I guess you'd say I had a bad payer mix, but, interesting thing in Oregon, we have Oregon Health Plan, which is managed care Medicaid, and it's the prioritized list. Oregon's famous for its prioritized list. They rank the diagnoses from most critical to be covered down to least critical. And so in 2002, when there was a budget decline, most of my dermatology diagnoses got cut off from the list. And back then, Medicaid paid fairly poorly. Over the years, Medicare remained flat in their payment, and the Oregon Health Plan, the Medicaid, paid quite a bit better than Medicare. So I'm in a group that is allowing their overhead to go up in order to get that reimbursement from Medicaid. So the physicians in OB and pediatrics were doing quite well while my pay was nosediving. So because I had a different payer mix. And also, I'd been there a while, so I had a lot of patients growing into Medicare. So I had about half my practice was Medicare. So that's what happened to me.
I see. So, I mean, it's really fascinating because, you know, I mean, for most folks, certainly for folks that are employed in large health systems, this is all totally opaque to them.
And yes.
And, you know, and this, so just bear with us. So Oregon, you're saying, has a system where Medicaid, managed Medicaid, pays based on diagnoses, and the diagnoses is in terms of the value of the diagnosis, how important it is to cover.
Yes, yes.
And so managed Medicaid, which doesn't pay that much to begin with, is there only one managed Medicaid plan?
Actually, surprisingly, it began to pay very well, and that's a little known fact.
I see.
But it depends on the region and how good your group, your IPA. I mean, I know I'm throwing these acronyms out there, but, you know, the groups of doctors band together and they go to the state capital and they try to get good reimbursement for your area. And we're a very high Medicaid area. And so actually we were getting much better paid by Medicaid, but I had Medicare. So that I had a bad payer mix.
I understand. So can you just tell me a little bit about the history of Oregon and Medicaid in terms of how that all
Yeah, that's Governor Kitzhaber. I don't know all the details there, but it was very innovative and it sounded kind of good. And they thought, well, if we're going to ration care, let's be overt about it and let's decide which things are most important. So way back, my understanding is the number one diagnosis was intracranial hemorrhage, bleeding into the brain, of course. And then years later, the number one became prenatal care. And my little cynical view of that is perhaps that there's a lot more people getting paid for prenatal care than for intracranial hemorrhage. I don't know the politics of how they got rearranged, but it's arbitrary. It's political. So dermatology being mostly non-life-threatening when they had. So, you know, it used to cover, I don't know, down to line 600 or something, and now it's line 200. So it's line by line. The line has gone up. There's fewer things covered over the years.
So Medicaid traditionally did not pay very well at all. And suddenly they came up with this idea that they would pay better, but they would only pay for certain diagnoses. And over time, and they got everyone to buy in, and, you know, you sounded hopeful about it, like, oh, yeah, this is not a bad idea. And then over time, as happens to all systems like this, they started to winnow what they were covering. They started to decrease payments in one way or the other.
Exactly right. I never loved it, but at least it seemed fairly rational.
Okay.
And then it became more irrational.
What in this whole the Oregon tie this into the Oregon health experiment, the Oregon what is it called? I'm blanking on it.
Yeah, there was a study, and again, I can't quote, but there was a study where they compared people on Oregon Health Plan.
So it's the case that not everyone, I mean, it's not that everyone can be covered by the Medicaid plan because there's not enough money to cover everyone. So you have to have a lottery to decide who is and who isn't covered by Medicaid, correct?
Correct. And I don't know the current status of the lottery, but you know, for people who are working, there was a lottery because people wanted to get on it.
I see. Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. And then, and there was a study that was done by, I think, Kathleen Baker, who's an economist, who saw this as a brilliant way to kind of, this was essentially a randomized control trial of Medicaid. And that's a very famous paper now in terms of Medicaid versus non-Medicaid and how people do and whether or not lives are saved or not. They're not.
Yes, correct.
but that was all happening well before the ACA. Is that correct?
It was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And the issue was is that Medicare, which was traditional Medicare, Kathleen? Is that what
Yes, it was traditional Medicare.
Mm-hmm. And traditional Medicare, you found for a while, doesn't pay well for dermatology?
I guess I'm still a little bit of an outlier. I guess I'm always a bit of an outlier. Mm-hmm. But, you know, out on the coast, we have very few dermatologists and people have come a very long way. I have people coming from 2 hours away who have serious skin conditions like bullous pemphigoid, autoimmune blistering. And, you know, I am a careful, thorough doctor. And so, you know, people are starting to get squeezed. And I think the thing that has happened that we've seen in dermatology is that people are going faster and faster and delegating more tasks to non-physician providers. I don't like the word provider, but non-physicians. And I very stubbornly stuck with my way of practice, which is thorough and careful. But still was kind of being, you know, worked to death, run into the ground. You know, I taught patients to expect thorough care and, you know, I didn't limit them to one or two or three things. They come in with their list of six things. They've waited 3 months for their appointment. And so, you know, I gave them what they wanted, which was addressing all those things and then build what I did is honestly and completely. But, you know, after a while, that didn't work anymore.
Yeah. So. Kathleen, I totally see why the writing was on the wall for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
So, Kathleen, were you, I suppose you were either a partner of that group or on the partner track or something. I mean, where supposedly you're sort of part owner of the group.
I was a partner and I was on the executive committee and, you know, had been in the group a long time. Those are all my friends. I was happy there.
Right. But how much did you feel that you could control did you feel that things could be done differently compared to what the rest of the group wanted to be done? Or did you think that there was really no margin of maneuver, that there was only one way to respond to the situation?
Well, that's an interesting question because I wanted to figure out how I could get out of some of these things, out of Medicare and stay within my group. Because I just felt comfortable there. And my husband, who's helped me with all of this, said, you know, okay, that's not going to work. But it took me a while to be convinced that that wasn't going to work.
Right. Did you even float the idea by your partners or?
They weren't interested in it. Right. You know? Yeah.
Right. And in terms of, I mean, did you have a... You could see your own income was sort of carved out. I mean, it was based on whatever you were generating, that sort of thing for the most part. Or
yes, we had a very complicated formula that you know, I'd been involved in designing the formula to try to be fair, but it's a production formula, and so we had certain expenses that were, you know, your own expense, like suture materials, stuff that was just mine. And then we had things that were shared by the group. So, and we saw each other's paychecks too. Every month we saw each other's paychecks, kind of a complicated little thing that kind of ratcheted so that you weren't, you know, if you took vacation, you weren't punished too much, you know, it kind of worked out over like 6 months. I think a lot of groups have those sorts of formulas.
It's complicated, isn't it? I mean, it's almost, impossible to, you know, people, some people want to, you know, are actually more productive than others. Some people, it's the nature of their work that demands this or demands that, or more time or less time, or they can be more efficient or less efficient, or it's reimbursed better by just by the you know, the absurdity and the arbitrariness of the reimbursement schemes, right? So certain specialties are privileged in that way. And it's very hard to get together as a group, even as well-meaning as everybody may be. And
it's because in this particular case that it sounds like you have a fee-for-service volume-based productivity practice, right? And Kathleen was attempting to push back on that, right? She wanted to deliver quality care that may take a fair amount of time per patient for somebody who's traveled 3 hours that you don't want to necessarily bring back every week for, you know, for some other problem that they have. And that type of care model doesn't fit with volume-based reimbursement. So you can see why, you know, you were probably incredibly frustrated by this whole thing. So essentially you were being forced to either hire a bunch of PAs and see 50 or 60 people a day, which is what a lot of dermatologists do, right?
Yes.
And kind of oversee them and become a billing machine, or continue to provide, you know, one-on-one quality care like you were, you know, or that you wanted to give.
Well, it's not an accident that we named my new practice Oregon Coast Dermatology, which is also an abbreviation for OCD. you know, I mean, some of it is just personal style, personal practice style. But I don't know. I can't cut people off. I don't do that. I did train a nurse practitioner for a year, and I wasn't really totally comfortable with all that. And she left because her husband wanted to get work elsewhere. So I don't know. I guess I'm just someone who goes a different way.
Yeah. And then in 2011, were there specific pressures that the ACA? So the ACA was not in your particular case was not going to increase reimbursement for what you were doing. Is that accurate?
Even before that, I just kind of, I don't know. I just said, I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
I was like, I've had enough. I reached my, you know, straw on the camel's back moment where I just went, no, I'm not going to do that. And
which part of it was it that you found the most difficult to deal with, or?
Any little bit more whatsoever.
Right.
And yes. So you open up a practice. how far away from your old practice, or?
Within 2 miles, and I'm on very good terms with them.
Okay. All right. And this was a purely cash-based practice, which didn't take insurance. Is that right? Or
correct.
Yeah.
Correct. So, right.
So
from the beginning.
How did you get to that point? Because in, you know, that's when I did. That's when I jumped ship also in 2011. There weren't that many people doing that at the time. I mean, certainly not. I mean, in cardiology, it's still a rarity. I mean, I'm the only lunatic one on the planet doing this. But
I love it.
But in internal medicine, it was not very common. And in dermatology, I suspect there may be some who do high-end, primarily aesthetic dermatology, who may be cash only.
Yes, I think in places like Manhattan and LA, there's quite a bit of that, but they're not out there saying, I'm doing something different. They're just catering to that segment of the market that is used to receiving excellent service and can afford it.
Right. So what made you even consider the possibility of doing something cash-based? Because, you know, it was completely out of my radar for years. I mean, it came on my radar, I would say, probably in 2007, 2008, and it took me about 3 years to muster the, you know, I wouldn't say the wherewithal, but to muster whatever it takes to sort of make the final jump.
Well, it was in my head for years, my ideal how I would like to do it, you know. I actually saw this practice, Bay Clinic, I sought them out. I was looking for, you know, because I came from Baltimore with the HMOs and I hated that, you know. So at the time I joined Bay Clinic, they had a really excellent group of internists and I was an internist still. And it's just over time, you know, trying to still practice that way was becoming increasingly difficult. So yes, I think the internists were unhappy with it too, but they just came to a different conclusion as to what sort of you know, radical, you know, I'm the radical. I did took, but it was with the help of my husband, because he's like, well, it's obvious, you just set a price. And, you know, here he's a business person, you know, set a price, offer a great product, let people know and see if they will come.
Do you, before we talk about your experience, do you miss internal medicine, or did you miss it when you you found yourself having to do dermatology primarily within that group?
No, I'm a very visual person. I really enjoy the surgical procedures and the visual aspects of dermatology. But I think doing internal medicine the way that I'm doing dermatology now, I think would be great. You know, again, have the time to spend with people. I think that would be great. But I think I blame CPT. I mean, I think CPT killed internal medicine. So
right.
That's my view.
For sure. So... So you have the support of your husband, which I think is important, right?
In your story. Well, he designed it for me. He listened to me complaining, and he actually, you know, he's just very entrepreneurial, and he did all the work of setting it up.
Right, including, I mean, then at that point, I mean, it's every single detail, what location, you know, negotiating a rent, what equipment you need, what... you know, you need to hire staff, somebody needs to do the bookkeeping, you need to buy a computer system, you need to order supplies. I mean, it's endless, right? And it's daunting.
He's my secret weapon, but I would like to replicate this. We are actually working on some projects. I know that's probably off base, but working on some projects to help other people do what I've done, because it's so nice. It's such a nice way to practice.
Wonderful. So Kathleen, but... you are, you've been practicing now for a while in model, and you've been successful. Would you say you've been successful?
Absolutely.
It would seem that given your prior pair mix, I don't know that I would have been so excited to advise somebody to go into what is a primarily Medicaid/Medicare population to try this, but you've been able to make it work. Is that true?
Yes. Well, right now I think my, if you would say payer mix, everybody pays the posted price, but I have about a third. Can you hear me? Okay.
He's still there. Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep, I can hear you. Yes.
About a third Medicare still. And even though, you know, they have their Medicare and their supplement, they come see me and pay me and they don't get reimbursed. And, so I have a little better mix in terms of, more young people, so it's a little more balanced practice. And, you know, before I just stopped taking new patients because I was full, and so, you know, it became kind of unbalanced, and I like seeing the full range of ages.
Did it take a while to turn profitable?
No, we were profitable immediately, away.
That includes the salary that you're paying yourself and whatnot. That wasn't...
It's not a salary, so it's purely profit based. So, like a restaurant would be, but you know, I think the first month we cleaned our own bathrooms, you know. But yes, right. We're profitable. I mean, whether you take money out of the business, I accumulated money in the business. We're older. My husband has a business.
Yeah.
No, I have a great deal of pride in that. I guess I'd be like Keith Smith. I mean, I'm like not going to do this unless I'm going to be profitable. So yes, but so, you know, to grow it and you know, bring in more profit over time.
Did you you've also mentioned or talked about that it's difficult to recruit people in this environment? Can you talk about why that is?
Let's actually, before we get there, I want to continue to explore how you know, your success story, Kathleen, because you know, it's great, and I want to learn from it because I'm struggling. A lot of people are struggling. So the fact that you had been in the area for 15 years, maybe more, 15 years, 13, right before you opened, how many of the patients followed you, or you had a name for yourself? Was that, you know, from day one, did that make it easy?
Well, it helps that I'm in a shortage area, so there's that. But there's a lot of other people who are not dermatologists who are competing with me, and people will go see a nurse practitioner, a physician assistant. But you know, it does help that there's very few, and we're somewhat isolated. So that's actually an advantage in terms of demand. But a lot of people said I'll go elsewhere then, and you know, a good number of those came back.
Right, right, and. And then did you have to spend money in marketing or advertise, or how did you, or
well,
but there was sufficient to get you going from the beginning, and then it was word of mouth after that.
Well, I'll brag on my husband, Jack, again. He is a marketing genius. He really is. He loves marketing, and he doesn't like to spend a lot of money on it. And you know, one of the things we did, well, I'll tell you another thing in a sec, but we had an A-frame sign. It was very pretty. We had beautiful, location. You know, we had a beautiful location with nice signage and a classy looking establishment. We renovated our building. We have a building. But we had an A-frame up that said, accepting new patients, had my name, MD, and phone number. And we got more patients off that. Well, how did you find us? Oh, well, I jogged past your sign. So, you know, and then website and little cards, little postcards that had my picture. What do you call that? I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it was a nice little colored. It had my picture and the phone number, accepting new patients, and a map, you know.
I'm taking notes.
And we priced for growth initially. He's also very big on pricing. He's a pricing guru. We argue about pricing, okay? But you know, we priced for growth initially to get people coming in the door, and then over time, as we had increased demand, then we increased prices, which was very hard for me to do. So,
right, And did you need much of a sort of a, you know, I don't want to know the amount, but there was a little bit of savings. There had to be a little bit of savings before you made the jump.
I think, and I put about $6,000 cash into our checking account. But, you know, over time we paid for everything directly. We didn't borrow anything. But
right.
Again, we have another business. We've gone back and forth between the two of us and who's earning, you know, carrying the greater earnings load at times. So we renovated a building and really very, very little debt involved. I think I had a loan for my laser. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. And how did the enjoyment come immediately? It was immediate job satisfaction, all that, the good stuff.
Yes, it was a little scary at first because you do wonder, will people come? You know, when you have a gap, you're like, well, you know, it makes you nervous. But it very quickly, we got to a point where we're starting to schedule months out again. I was like, well, I don't want to go there again. I don't want to cut off taking new patients. So this is my idea. And he thought it wasn't a good one, but it was a great one. We did a walk-in one day a week. An afternoon, and we'd fill up and have to turn people away. And people come from, oh my gosh, I've had people from Portland, which is 4 hours away, and people come and sit and wait ahead of time. We're like, don't come that early, but they come and sit and wait. And they thank us every single time. They thank us for that. So.
Oh, really great.
And it's not discounted. People have a mistaken notion that that is discounted, but it's the same posted price. It's just you have access. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's amazing. And there are no other, I guess there's a paucity of dermatologists around.
There is. There's dermatologists who've been here longer than I have been, and he sold his practice recently to one of those large groups, and he's 76. He's down to 2 days a week. There's a nurse practitioner there. So, no, total paucity. We're in what's called a dermatology desert. That's not my term. I didn't make it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Right. I'm not in the cardiology desert or in the internal medicine desert. In the
location,
middle of San Francisco.
Location. You should come here. Oh, gosh.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Okay. So now you've been at it for 7 years?
Yeah. So over 7 years, almost eight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Yeah. And what's happened? What's changed? How does it look?
It's still awesome. I just have more than I can do. We're blocked out. Well, as I told you, I'm going to close. I'm 60, and we've reached a point where we're going to make some changes in our life, but not because it's not awesome. I mean, it's awesome. But I work very hard. I mean, if people are looking for an easy way to make a living, I work really hard. I try to give that value every day and do those extra things for people. And again, my OCD, you know, I call everybody with their biopsy results. I want to make sure I'm delivering every day on mm-hmm. that, on that excellence. Mm-hmm.
So you were, Anish was mentioning, you were trying to recruit, you were hoping to recruit somebody.
Yes. Yeah, so I mostly recruited through social media, and it's impossible to recruit a dermatologist to rural areas sometimes, but people were interested in my model. But ultimately, you have to have someone be willing to pick up roots and move, and it's a risk, and a lot of them have a lot of debt. So even though people were interested, I didn't have anyone sign a lease. I had someone who made a verbal commitment, and then they changed their minds and backed out of it. And so we just decided not to continue to do that because we don't have to, and because we want to go live in Montana. So that's it.
Is it the case? Do you think that the issue is that the amount that you can make in the practice is not enough to for the loans that these young graduates have? Or is it that there's the time commitment is too much to, you know, do this solo like you're doing it? Or
I think people want guarantees. You know, they're unhappy, some of them, with the supervising a lot of lesser trained people and taking on that risk. They're unhappy about that. They're unhappy about having not enough time with people, but they want security, and they already have all that debt. And they want security, and they're also, you know, they're talking to each other about, you know, how much you need to earn, and they expect a certain amount instead of looking at like long-term ownership of like how much can I make in terms of a salary. They're really thinking salary and what am I worth. I don't see this whole thing as being sustainable. You know, I see us on, you know, like on the Titanic, but with, well, you know, with the model that they're in, I see mine as being very secure. You might make less in the short run, depending, but you know, you don't have to make the same as you make in Chicago or San Francisco. You know, you don't. The living expenses are lower. So, you know, how much is enough for you to make, and do you feel comfortable with the way that you're practicing medicine? So I like the way that I'm practicing medicine. And oh, it's really hard doing the closing thing now too, because people are very, they're very upset about it. They're very upset that I'm going to close. My patients.
Sure. So. And so you said you tried to recruit through social media. Was it primarily the reaction that you've, you know, this lack of interest, is it from grads or from even people in practice? I mean, have you had any interest from people who are? I suspect, I mean, you know, we think dermatologists are pretty happy in general, but there must be some unhappy dermatologists.
Well, I mean, I think I got more people visiting here and seriously interested in it than if I were in the conventional. I think the key to the interest we had was because of my novel practice model. People, you know, like, wow, that sounds wonderful. And but, you know, they have roots. And so
right.
It's a rural area. It's hard to get here. It's beautiful. But I mean, there's a huge opportunity here for someone who wants to come in, or two people or three people who want to come in, but you have to get over the coastal mountains, and so getting places from here is challenging, and we're not near big cities, so you have to be an outdoors person, and so it needs a special person, and they also need to have a tolerance for risk. So
yeah, all of that is all that seems to be, well, yeah, I can see how that would seem to be challenging for like a fresh young grad coming out of out of residency. Are you optimistic about where healthcare is headed? It almost seems like, you know, as the third party payer, payer part of healthcare gets worse and worse, it actually increases opportunities for folks like you and for Michelle and the Surgery Center of Oklahoma.
Well, I think it's a real puzzlement, because I mean, I've thought about that a lot. I think more people ought to do what I'm doing. I just think it's the right thing for patient care. So, you know, physician needs to be happy, but, you know, I see, I'm sorry, appalling things happening in care. And, you know, it's like nobody's responsible for it.
What can you describe? What do you mean by appalling things? You mean in terms of how?
Not to be too ideological, but I mean, I just always think, you know, about the old Soviet system. I don't know if you met Yuri Maltsev. He's a really interesting guy. He's an economist, and he was an economist under Gorbachev in Soviet Union. He was a defector, and his stories. So I was just like, kind of, so sorry, comrade, can't do that for you. You know, it's just, you know, just appalling care, and nobody says, oh, I've got an obligation to do everything for you. I'm going to be your advocate. And
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. And I think it's, you know, the more unhappy doctors are, the more likely they are to take on that attitude. Because then you say, well, you know, I mean, I'm unhappy, and why should I, you know, go the extra mile when in fact I'm not going to be rewarded, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's a great little book by, I think, William Carter. He's deceased. He was an internist, called The 2 Days That Ruined Your Healthcare. And there's a little chapter in there. It's called My Doctor is Acting Funny. And it's something like, well, if I can't do a really great job, I might as well go to lunch.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't want to be too harsh on people, but
we have to wake them up. I'm trying to be harsh on my co-host here, but he's sort of
Teflon coated. You should do it. But I mean, you know, it's a little scary for people. Yeah.
It's so interesting that the massive focus from folks in health policy is we have expanded health coverage. Mm-hmm. More people have health insurance than ever before. Yet you're sitting in Coos Bay, Oregon, and you know, there are no dermatologists to see patients. I don't understand, Kathleen, why I thought healthcare is now a right. So, I mean, why is healthcare not being delivered to everyone?
Right. I don't know. I mean, I don't think it's a right. Of course I don't think it's a right. No, because then somebody else decides how much you get, and you're not going to get much. So it's a mess. I don't know where it's headed. I mean, I just think you have to, you know, my conclusion, I went to DC, I was like, you know, they need to fix it. I went there with a group of doctors, and, you know, my conclusion was, they don't understand it. They're not going to fix it. I need to fix my own problems. That was my conclusion, you know?
Yeah, that's right. You've been fairly active in terms of trying to pass bills and legislation and whatnot. Have your interactions with politicians in the local sphere, in the national, I guess, I don't know who exactly you've interacted with at what levels, but are they all relatively clueless? And if they are so clueless, why are they so clueless?
Well, yeah, I had so much fun going to Salem, which is the capital of Oregon. And I hired a lobbyist, a legislative consultant, who charged me hardly anything. He was so sweet, and he believed in what I was doing. He was just a great guy. He's a former senator, state senator. And, you know, he did teach me, you know, I have my own political opinions, but he taught me to talk across the aisle. And I was amazed that there were people who, like, got it. But when it came down to getting something out of committee, oh, no, they wouldn't. You know, they're like, it was eye-opening. They were stunned by certain things that I said, but the health insurance people. So yeah, I didn't have anything to do with federal or state programs, but really private health insurers having to do with the stacked deductibles. And they came out in force, and my state medical association came out against me too. You know, I just was working in the out of network sphere. You know, they have the stacked deductible that Keith Smith talked about too, that, you know, people can't get their insurance money to pay for something that, you know, I was very naive actually. I thought that the health insurance companies would love it, that I offered certain things that were a great bargain. Instead of, you know, going to the outpatient surgery center and have your basal cell carcinoma excised on your forehead for $4,000, I did it in the office for $500 with a fancy flap repair, you know, and they were like, wow, you know, and then the insurance companies come in and they go, she's costing us money, and pointed at me. She's the only one in our 4 states. She's costing us money. Because basically what they're saying is that processing the claim was going to cost far more than the cost of providing the care. And so the legislators kind of dropped their jaw and went, oh, wow, that's interesting. But nothing happened, you know. My bills didn't get out of committee, so.
I'm utterly politically naive, and I, for the life of me, cannot understand why the insurance companies have such a lock on both left and right. I mean, there's no difference. There's literally the establishment left and the establishment right. Both are, you know, solidly behind insuring all of America and making sure that we all will pay, you know, whatever, $400 a month or and more to insurance companies to insure us for, you know.
Well, I think they have a great scam, and so do a lot of politicians. And the scam is telling people that without us, it's going to be ridiculously expensive, when actually I think they're the cause of it being ridiculously expensive.
So when you say that, I guess that the problem is these politicians, I mean, what is the deal here? When the politicians must be able to understand this, right? I mean, you are able to do the same procedure for 8 times less.
Yes. I mean, now some things will be more. I mean, some things will be more, but I mean, it just, I'm based on my costs. I figure out what are the costs that I have.
Right.
Of course, you see, there's times when I saw this at my previous practice, you know, things that pay well, people will get more of them. Things that pay poorly, people will get less. And that's a very sad indictment on the medical profession, that, you know, we are influenced by, is something reimbursed or paid well? So, yeah. I don't know where I was headed with that, but
but the question is, how do we, I guess the only solution is to try to go directly to people. I mean, go to the masses or be a populist like Donald Trump, or how do we do this?
I mean, I'm convinced that you can't fix it top down. And I think that we need to be allowed the space. And that's why I advocate for, on a political level, is just let us have a little space to provide an alternative. And no matter where people are politically, they can be relied on to do what's best for themselves. It's so amazing. I have people come in my practice who are affluent and Bernie Sanders supporters, and they have their Bernie buttons on and their Medicare and Medicaid, and they come in and they pay for care, which is completely opposed to what they say they believe. So why do they do that? You know, I don't know why they do that. I mean, they think it's what's best for them, and they thank you and they're so sweet, but they got their little button on that wants to outlaw. They want to outlaw what I do.
Right. Right. No, the contradiction is really, amazing, and, you know, in a way incomprehensible, but it's
why should perhaps not allow Bernie supporters in.
No, we don't discriminate. I mean, I'll see anybody.
I think partly is because, you know, the private sector has been so vilified for so long. You know, I mean, I don't know. It's true what you say. It's true. I mean, I have the same experience. I mean, here I have many patients who strongly believe, you know, did believe in Obamacare and now would believe in Medicare for all. But you're right, for themselves, they're more than happy to pay cash, and they don't see the disconnect.
Well, they would really rather it be free, but they want what they want, and if they have to pay for it, then they will.
Right. Right.
And they can't get what they want elsewhere, you know.
Right.
And it's not just lack of, I mean, they, you know, there are people they can see, they can go out of town, etc. So part of it is there's lack of dermatologists. But, they, you know, there are a lot of people who, you know, I'll biopsy, I'll diagnose a skin cancer. They've Medicaid, they have Medicare, Medicare and a supplement. They met their deductible. They're not going to have to pay anything. And they come in my office and have an excision done by me for, you know, $700 instead of, quote, free. Why do they do that? We provide them with an experience where they feel they trust, I think. They trust and they feel cared for, and they know that, I mean, I give them my cell phone and my email and, you know, all of that. They know that they're not, if they have a problem, I'm there for them. So I'm not sure why they choose it either. I'm always like, I come on again, I tell my husband, I was like, wow, they had Medicare and a supplement, and they came and they paid for the surgery that they could have had, quote, free, but they came to me. Why did they do that? You know, I think I do nice surgical work.
Right. You know, before we close, Kathleen, I want to go back to what you were saying about the job security in the long term in doing what you're doing. Because that's a very important point, I think, to get across, to try to motivate you know, any physician listening who might be considering doing that. Because that, to me, that was a strong motivation. I was wrong. I mean, I thought, so I had a hunch in 2006, 2007, yeah, even 2007, I had a hunch, and you know what I was reading, that the economy, that was before the bubble burst, but I had a feeling that it might. And then I thought, and I knew that, you know, by then I knew that the system was unsustainable, it seemed. I was working for Kaiser Permanente, the largest MO here, and I could see, you know, that there was a lot of waste. And I thought, you know, this is not sustainable. I mean, that is going to crumble. And I thought it might crumble in 2008. So I thought, well, I better get out before Kaiser Permanente goes bankrupt. Well, they're not going bankrupt, you know. So I'm the one struggling. But on the other hand, I still think that it's very precarious. And certainly a doctor working in the system is in a precarious situation because they're so dependent on that system, you know, that, you know, being around for a few more years when it might, I mean, the numbers look, you know, someday it's going to crumble. Now, of course, it may take another 50 years and maybe this generation will escape, but it may not. And I just didn't want to gamble. I thought, you know, I'd rather have it on me. I'd rather take the responsibility myself and feel more secure, even though in the short run it may seem you know, much more difficult. So what you were saying about this, you know, ownership, most of us, you know, our greatest asset is our professional skill or skills, right? I mean, that's really by and it's an asset that cannot be taken away. Everything else can be taken away, but what we know, what we can do for others is really the number one asset. And to put it at the mercy of a system that is, you know, wasteful, unethical, problematic, you know, dysfunctional and all that, to me is an incredible risk. And I would hope that, you know, I'm hoping that this line of reasoning motivates others to view it that way, to say, yes, you know, this is really way too risky to stay in the system. I better get out soon.
I think if people feel that they're not providing great care, they need to be self-honest. And, you know, the problem is for dermatology is relatively easy because I can get my own equipment and I don't need the hospital. People are dependent on the system. But if you're providing lousy care, you're part of a system that provides lousy care. I'm sorry, you're partly responsible.
Mm-hmm. Right. You know, there was, I don't know if you saw it, there was an editorial by a cardiologist, Milton Packer. I like what he writes. He, you know, people find it very controversial. You know, he himself, he works in the system. He was an academic for many years. He still is involved in clinical trials, that sort of thing. But he was making a, you know, a comment about, particularly about academic physicians and about why, you know, academic centers are having difficulty. And he said, you know, if you're satisfied with a 10-minute visit as a doctor, right? I mean, patients are recognizing that it means that you don't really care about them, and you don't have to in a way. And many doctors have, what we were talking about earlier, have just bought into that idea that they can't, you know, it's not them, it's the system imposing those 10-minute visits and the lousy care that goes with that. Right.
Right.
But in fact, it's them, because they are actively, you know, materially complicit in keeping the system going.
Well, it kills me that I hear doctors say, well, medicine is not, you know, a job, it's a calling. And yet, you know, they want this huge amount of money. Yes, they have a lot of debt. And they are led around by the money. And I'm totally pro-profit. But, you know, you shouldn't, the way you pay shouldn't be you are paid should not be in conflict with your values as a physician. You know, you need to put that patient first. And if you're not able to do that, how can you be happy? You know?
Right. Amen. So, you hear that, co-host?
Preach into the converted.
Half converted.
Come on over. It's not that scary. It works. You have to have the business skills too, though.
Right. That's something that I could use help with for sure.
And that's something that's really important. I mean, I've heard more than one person say over and over again that the new era that you and Kathleen would usher in is not necessarily going to be an easier one for most physicians, right? The vast majority of physicians are super happy clocking in and clocking out and making, a significant amount of money regardless of how well they did their job that day. But this brave new world that you're talking about is one where, you really have to be good in a multi-faceted way. You have to be attractive and affable to your patients. I don't have a problem with that, but you have to have business acumen.
Hopefully good at what you do. Patients are vulnerable. That's the whole system is based on a foundation of trust. And, so I had this young guy, I know we wrap up, but young guy come in and he's seen four other people. I said, so-and-so is not a doctor. He didn't care in the least. He cared that, it was easy for me. He came in, I said, you have this. It was easy for me because it's what I do and I have a lot of experience and I'm good at what I do. Yeah. And he didn't care who they were or what their credentials or their licensing or any of that. He just wanted someone to get it right.
Yeah, but there's plenty of technicians who right now are surgeons who perhaps don't have the best bedside manner. They may be technically very good. And they, they hide. They may not have the best post-op follow-up and stuff, but they're you can hide in these large systems where you have these massive referral bases that just feed you patients all the time. And so, we as a physician group are in some ways the biggest barrier
Absolutely. My patients got it so much faster than physicians. Physicians just couldn't even see it. How could that possibly work? Where patients get it immediately.
Right, because your medical board came out against you, right?
Not the board. Physician association, because they sell a lot of CPT stuff, compliance stuff. I mean, they don't say that's why they came against it, but of course it is. My most radical thing is I don't bill by CPT. I bill by time. Yeah. So, how dare you do that?
Yeah. These narrow-minded, it's very frustrating. But perhaps the best we can hope for is for a large group of folks to be incompetent enough to not give folks like you and Michelle a tremendous amount of competition to thrive.
I welcome the competition. Bring it on.
Kathleen, before we close, you were alluding to a possible project. I don't know if you're ready to talk about it. Something to help others.
Tell us
because you're going to close your clinic, but it'd be a shame for all that experience not to to be passed on.
Yes, and there's opportunity here. So if dermatologists want to come here, whether they're direct pay or not, there's tremendous opportunity here to serve wonderful people. But my medical school is Eastern Virginia Medical in Norfolk, Virginia, and I went to William & Mary undergraduate, which is the second oldest school in the country, and my husband went to business school there. So we have contacts, and we're a three-generation William & Mary family, and so we are working on an elective for medical students and young physicians on, it'll be short, business skills, entrepreneurism, ethics, economics, philosophy, very compact. So these people who are still idealists, we can give them some practical tools, whether it's in a DPC or direct pay or even as an employee, to understand what it is that they're getting into, and to stop saying that business is bad, but letting someone else make all the business decisions. So, and personal finance.
And that would take what form would it take? Would it be
you know, we're working that out, but we're thinking it may be, you know, a couple of weeks. And probably the business school, their entrepreneurism center, coming to the campus of Eastern Virginia initially. We're going to first prove the concept and then hopefully expand it and, you know, may have some online capabilities. So right now we got to, you know, and the medical students are very excited about it.
That sounds great. Are you involved with the Benjamin Rush Institute?
Or I am.
You are.
My husband's
okay.
on the board.
Okay, great.
Jack
okay.
Brown. He's on the board of Benjamin Rush. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Small world.
Well, Kathleen, that's terrific. I really enjoyed this conversation very, very much. It's inspiring. You know, you haven't been able to keep the clinic open, but you know, there are local factors, I think, in that regard. And otherwise, I'm very happy to hear that there are, you know, plans to pass on this tremendous experience that you and your husband have.
We have other doctors who are doing it. We have helped other doctors. They're just not here in Coos Bay. It's a small movement at this time.
Right.
So.
Very good. Well, it's, you know, mid-December as we record this. I want to wish you very, very happy holidays to you and your husband and your family.
Thank you.
It's going to be our last recording of the year. It will come out, you know, probably in a couple of weeks. But we wish you very well, Kathleen.
Thank you. I can see you, but you can't see me. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Thanks again.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Akkad and Coca Report. Subscribe for free on iTunes or Stitcher at akkadandcoca.com, where you'll find detailed show notes, our blog, and more. akkadandcoca.com.